All right, the Minnesota House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform for the 92nd State Legislative Session will come to order, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Rep. Johnson.
Present.
Rep. Edelson. Rep. Feist.
Present.
Rep. Grossel.
Present.
Rep. Hollins.
Present.
Rep. Hewitt.
Present.
Rep. Cleavorn.
Carl, hang on. Carl, hang on just a second.
Cleavorn, present.
Rep. Long.
Present.
Rep. Lucero.
What? St. Patty didn't wear green?
Rep. Mueller.
I am also not wearing green. I'm sorry.
Rep. Novotny.
Novotny, present.
Rep. O'Neill.
O'Neill, present.
Rep. Pinto.
Present.
Rep. Poston.
Present.
Rep. Raleigh.
Talancha.
Rep. Vang.
Present.
Rep. Shung.
Present.
And that concludes roll call, Chair. A quorum is present.
Fantastic. Quorum is present. This hearing is being conducted under House Rule, Minnesota House Rule 10.01, allowing for hearings to be held via use of distance voting, remote electronic voting, or voting by other means to protect the health and safety of the public, safe staff and members. This hearing is live streamed on the House website and can be accessed via the committee page on the House website. Those wishing to offer public testimony can contact via email the committee administrator, Mr. Jamal Lundy, 24 hours prior to a hearing. That address is also available on our committee page. Representative Frazier, would you be so kind as to move the minutes of March 15th?
So moved, Chair.
Minutes of March 15th are moved. Discussion? Lee Johnson, voice vote, I take it?
That would be fine.
Very well. All in favor of adoption of the minutes of March 15th, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. In the minutes of March 15th are hereby adopted. No members. Today's theme is not St. Patrick's Day. Today's theme, neither is it the March Madness theme, although I'm paying close attention to all of that. Today's theme is our Department of Corrections Policy Day. We have several bills emanating from and or impacting the Department of Corrections. Tomorrow, we will hear from the Department of Corrections and Department of Public Safety for their budget requests. And so we're gonna spend the next 48 hours deeply immersed in department policies and finance issues. The first bill for today is House File 3949, Department of Corrections Ombuds Person issue. And so the chair moves, that's my bill, so the chair will move that House File 3949 be referred to the General Register. And members, as you all know, Minnesota, as usual, was on the front lines of good governance and good public policy years ago in creating the nation's first ombudsperson for corrections. That office is entrusted with a very important duty, and that is to make sure that the state and local jurisdictions who hold people in custody, that they're observing the constitutional rights and care, providing for care and safety, and tending to the health of those in custody. The purpose of the office is in large part to serve as a strong autonomous set of eyes to make sure that our government is fulfilling that important obligation. And as you can imagine, sometimes that means that it may need to call out things that aren't working well or aren't being done properly. And you can imagine that that might not make those in power happy. And so the idea behind this bill is to really strengthen our expectation that that office be able to conduct its work independent of you know, considering whether or not there'll be retribution for calling out things that may not be popular you know, with our authorities. And so this legislation would allow, require rather, that the ombudsperson can only be removed from his or her position for just cause. And so therefore by extension, you know, doesn't serve simply at the pleasure of the governor. So with us today is our interim ombudsperson, Margaret Sandra. Boy, Margaret, I didn't realize you were still interim, but anyway, it's always good to have you and good to see you again. You can come forward, give us your name and testimony. We'd appreciate it.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Mariani and committee members. Thank you so much for having me here today to talk about HF 3949. My name is Margaret Zadra, and as the chair said, I am the interim ombudsperson for corrections. And as you all know, that due to the diligence and bipartisan work from so many of you, that the Office of the Ombuds for Corrections was newly reestablished in the 2019 session. You know, as the chair mentioned, the office is completely separate and independent from the Department of Corrections, and our statutory mission is to promote the highest attainable standards of competence, efficiency, and justice in the administration of corrections. Part of how we do that is we can receive, investigate, and resolve complaints and provide an impartial and unbiased process for incarcerated individuals, staff members, and community members to share concerns about corrections agencies, actions, and policies. We also provide education and information to help people navigate the correction system. And we can publish reports and make recommendations to the DOC, the legislature, and the governor. In that way, we're able to take issues that may be brought forth by one or two or even just a handful of individuals and make recommendations that make the process more just and efficient for everyone. You can find all of our report, all of our public reports, including our annual report and our legislative priorities on our website at mn.gov/obfc. And just a quick aside, one of those reports brought forth some other legislative priorities. It was an in-depth report about strengthening and supporting family members of currently incarcerated people. And later today, I'm really grateful to see that Representative Pinto's bill, HF 4191, does that. It provides more support within the DOC for supporting families. So just a really quick aside and voice of support for that bill and then our overall work. The bill before you today, HF 3949, came about as we were looking at best practices. So not just for the DOC, but also for our own agency. We realized our own enabling legislation could use a little bit of tightening up. HF 3949 provides ombudsperson removal only for just cause. As a government oversight entity representing the people of Minnesota, our office should be as free as possible from outside control or influence or even the perception of that. And I think that piece of it is incredibly important. The possibility of removal from office and retribution for carrying out an unpopular investigation or making a critical report or for political reasons can be a real or indirect threat to the independence of the ombuds. Both the United States Ombuds Association's own standards include removal only for just cause, as well as other ombuds offices here in the state of Minnesota have removal only for just cause. You should be able to find in your materials today a letter of support from the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. And I know you have a really full agenda today, so I don't want to take up too much time. And it's a pretty straightforward bill. Although important, but I'm happy to answer any questions that anybody might have.
Very well. Thank you, Ombudsperson Zadra. There are no other testifiers, and so we'll go to committee questions and discussions. We'll begin with Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. Two questions. There should be pretty straightforward. The new language will say that the governor shall, let me get to it. It's line 1.9, that the ombudsperson shall be appointed by the governor. And then it says that may be removed only for just cause. So the two questions that I've got are, what would be the process of removal? Would it be solely left to the pleasure of the governor, or is there a different process? And then I've been looking for, and the testimony said that there are other offices of ombudspersons. What would be the definition of just cause? I've seen several different explanations of just cause, and I'm just wondering if the testifiers could give us a little bit more insight into what just cause means. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Rowley. We may call on our legal counsel to help with this as well, with the two questions, but I'll turn to Ombudsperson Zandro first.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and Representative Rowley. So for the first one, currently it is, you know, appointed by the governor and serving at the pleasure of the governor, so that would change to appointed by the governor and removal for just cause. I think the process for that would also be initiated then by the governor. And yeah, I'm not an attorney, so of course we'll defer to counsel on that, but just cause is a specific legal term. And the definitions that I found is that just cause includes, but is not limited to, consistent failure to perform assigned duties, substandard performance, insubordination, and serious violation of written policies and procedure.
Why don't we, Representative Rowley, why don't we turn to our legal counsel and see if they might be able to add something to that.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon, Mr. Devo.
I think the interim ombudsman identified the basic elements of just cause. There has to be some reason based in law or performance to justify. It can't be a whim or at the pleasure of the governor because of some other unwork-related reason. But I think it's more of a civil law issue, so I'm not an expert in that area, but I think she's done a good job of identifying that as a substantive grounds for termination.
Representative Rowley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I agree with the testifiers. There are several different standards that I've read so far as just cause. Some of them go into moral turpitude. Some of them go into job performance. And I'm still unclear on how the removal process would happen. Again, we know that it's appointment by the governor, and then it was stated that it would be initiated by the governor for removal. Is there, I guess, what would the vetting process be? And if it's not clear, Mr. Chair, I totally get it. It's just, I'm looking more for how does it get initiated, and then what's the process? Because I want to make sure that if this does happen in the future, that we know that that documentation was done correctly, or that the justification was actually in place. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Rowley. I would note that Ombudsperson Zandro did share that correct me if I'm wrong, but the language proposed here is similar or the same as what we currently use with the ombudspersons for health, disabilities, and perhaps some others. That still doesn't directly answer your question, but acknowledge it. But I just want to point out that, you know, there is a contextual current, framework that's being used. I also am not an employment attorney or civil attorney, but I'll certainly, call on our legal counsel again to share what he knows, and he may not have this knowledge in terms of what, you know, those employment processes would involve in state state appointments and state employment.
Jeff Diebling, House Research. Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm not an expert in that matter, and I'd be going way out onto thin ice if I were to offer an opinion on that. It should be left to the experts in the civil law area.
Indeed.
and governmental operations.
Representative Raleigh, and we may want to do some follow-up with you and other members to make sure we have some answers to that. If something this bill goes forward, it would be wise for the author, in this case me, to be prepared to answer that question, particularly like on the House floor. So, Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I'm not trying to trap you. I'm truly curious what the process is. And so I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Rowley. Lee Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members, I do have some serious concerns after the questions that couldn't be answered by Representative Raleigh. I've been thinking about it and looking with this person appointed by the governor. The issue of just cause brings up, this is an appointment, it's not a hire. The employees can be fired under just cause, which like any other employee. But this position is the one who makes the policies, the one who directs the employees working there on what they should do and how they should do things. So if it's just cause gets a little shadier and a little grayer in how it works. We also have the issue where an appointment could be made 2 days before the governor leaves office, or the day before, or the day of the governor leaves office, and the incoming governor would have no say on who that person could be. I think we should look at, I understand the need that it needs to be totally separate from the department, totally separate from the governor. So to be totally independent. And to make that, I think we should look at more, not just the governor appointment, but some sort of ratification by this body, either the House, the Senate, or both. It's an issue that we want to make sure we have the right person there that's working in the best interest of the state and also in the best interest of those confined in incarceration to make sure that their constitutional rights are not violated and then make sure everybody's doing what they should be doing. And with this issue that was brought up by Representative Raleigh, I think we should actually, instead of going to the general register, and I know Representative or Chair Becker Finn wouldn't like this, but I think it might need to go to civil law to deal with those issues, right? Civil law and data or in the judiciary, because there is some questions on how it would actually work. And it brings up questions with the other arm of this person that we have that is can only be removed for just cause. Because it could be with a person appointed, given a hired position, it could be make it a really high bar for a person not doing their job properly. But because the way it's worded, it might be very difficult to have that person removed if they're not doing their job correctly, just because they are have the same rights as any other employee and not just an appointed employee.
Lee Johnson, I appreciate the observances. I would, rebut. One, I don't, on the ratification issue, I'm pretty certain we don't ratify all appointments across state government of this nature. I doubt we're doing the ratification of our ombudspersons pretty much anywhere. In state government, I think that could well be arguably a recipe for gridlock of our ability to carry out important functions. Ratification, of commissioners makes sense because, that's kind of where the buck stops, in terms of each one of those areas. This is really about, efficiency, effectiveness of our state government, and observance of the rights of our individual citizens. And that relates to, in my mind, to the second, rebut, where I think your scenario actually makes the case, which is that if a new incoming governor under that scenario would quote unquote have no say, that really begs the question, well, so are we setting up in a scenario that you see in other countries? I'm Puerto Rican. This happens in Puerto Rico all the time. One governor comes in from another party, everybody goes out. It leads to a pretty dysfunctional governance, and no wonder that territory is under, in my opinion, under incredible stress and dysfunctionality. And so, seems to me if another governor comes in, he or she is not barred under this language from taking appropriate action under a just cause frame. I think what we don't want, I know what we don't want, is for a governor to take action simply based on the fact that his or her predecessor was from another party. So I think it all makes for good discussion and diving into debate so that we can be clear about what our intentions and our design is for state government governance. But I don't think that, I don't share the concerns that you have at this point. Representative Fraser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I would like to respond.
Well, certainly, sir, please.
Yeah, I agree with some of your points, but with the current system we have, all our commissioners upon changing the governor are gone. We have that now. The employees continue working and doing their job. Somebody's, a deputy commissioner steps in or just fills until a commissioner has been appointed. With this honor, this person is different. Because we want to make sure that the right person is there. To make sure that they are representing properly and not with their own agenda or the agenda of the prior governor, if that may be. But we want to make sure that the person is the best qualified for that position. And I think the more people that look at that and come forward, we can put in statute that it has to be done by a certain, a ratification has to be done by a certain time after appointment, or it's considered an appointment. No action could be an action. But it gives an opportunity to really vet that person to make sure that it's the right person that is there. Thank you,
Lee Johnson. And I'll take a bit of the debate here. I am pretty certain that a number of recent behaviors of the other body relative to ratification had almost nothing to do with the quality, the objective professionalism, and effectiveness of the individuals that they then denied ratification to. That is another debate. And so I don't want to get us into this debate, but I could not, allow the assertion that a ratification process in this environment, the legislature, is always going to produce a focus on quality and professionalism. I think our history over time is mixed on that. I also would not presume that a prior governor's appointment a prior governor's decision to appoint someone resulted in that governor appointing someone who is not qualified. That may well be, but I certainly do not want to presume that. And what you have is an objective standard used across the board, across the nation, with other, also in other jurisdictions in our state government. I mean, we can all we can all choose to vote against, you know, an objective just cause standard. That's certainly your right. But that's the only thing that this legislation proposes to do. I don't see any more hands up. Lee Johnson, your hand is up. I don't know if that's from prior.
No, that is up again. And I understand, but with the ratification process, whether they go through with it or we put in there that's got to be done by a certain date after appointment, it forces the hand to actually look at it. Look at, make sure that the person is the right qualified. And this is a little different than any other appointment by the governor. This is basically a lifetime appointment until they decide to leave. With all our other commissions and all our other things, except for the Supreme Court, who has to go through election process, or judges that would have to be elected at some point and the people have a voice, there is no other voice than the governor, than the appointing governor. They're there forever. Everybody else's appointments run out at a certain time. They either have to be reappointed or do some type of election to get back on to where they were. So this omnibus person is a little different. And I think we, even in the other omnibus persons, that it's just cause, we need to start looking at something like that to make sure. Granted, I'm guessing 99.9% of the time, the governor's going to appoint somebody well qualified. But does it hurt to have somebody else verify? You know, this is the one term that one person had said, trust but verify. Verification is always good to make sure we're doing it right.
Representative Bento.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to note, I did a quick search and found, there are, and maybe Lee Johnson was alluding to this, but other examples of ombudspersons who may be only for just cause. I'm looking at 245.92, which is our ombudsman for persons receiving services or treatment for mental illness and chemical dependency, et cetera. And this person is appointed by the governor, may be removed only for just cause. So I think this is a very standard thing that's happening throughout our state. And it sure seems like it makes a lot of sense in this case as well. Thank you.
Very well. Members, I don't see any other hands up. And so the chair renews his motion that House File 3949 be referred to the General Register, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier?
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Lee Johnson?
No.
Lee Johnson, nay. Rep Edelson?
Aye.
Rep Edelson, aye. Rep Feist?
Aye.
Rep Feist, aye. Rep Grossel?
No.
Rep Grossel, nay. Rep Hollins?
Aye.
Rep Hollins, aye. Rep Hewitt?
Aye.
Rep Hewitt, aye. Rep Cleavorn?
Cleavorn, aye.
Rep Cleavorn, aye. Rep Long?
Aye.
Rep Long, aye. Rep Lucero?
No.
Rep Lucero, nay. Rep Mueller?
Mueller, no.
Rep Mueller, nay. Rep Novotny?
Novotny, no.
Rep Novotny, nay. Rep O'Neill?
O'Neill, no.
Rep O'Neill, nay. Rep Pinto?
Aye.
Rep Pinto, aye. Rep Poston?
Poston, no.
Rep Poston, nay. Rep Raleigh?
Raleigh, nay.
Rep Raleigh, nay. Rep Vang?
Aye.
Rep Vang, aye. Rep Shung?
Shung, aye.
Shung, aye. Chair, that concludes roll call with 11 ayes and 8 nays.
Very well. With a vote of 11 ayes and 8 nays, the motion prevails. And House File 3949 is referred to the General Register. Representative Noor, you're next. I hope you're here. Chair Noor.
I'm here, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Representative Frazier, if you can move House File 4215. And I believe, Representative Noor, you want this to go to the Committee on Workforce Development?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Representative Frazier?
Absolutely, Chair. So moved.
Very well. Motion is before us. Bill is before us. Representative Noor, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 4215 creates stronger pathways from prison to employment, or what I call from jails to jobs, through investment at the Minnesota Department of Corrections. Members, this committee is tasked with passing laws to keep Minnesotans safe. I thank you for the work that you do every single day and your focus on investing in effective, practical, and proven solutions. Members, we must make public safety policy based on what works. We must make investments that are evidence-based in order to reduce crime and recidivism in our communities. However, it's not only this committee's task to do that work. There's a lot that needs to be done. Crime and public safety are closely linked to availability of housing, education, healthcare, and other basic needs. Mr. Chair and members, as you all know, as I chair the Workforce and Business Development, also shares in the responsibility by ensuring public safety. Public safety relies on people having what they need, staying employed and supporting themselves and their families. Members, when individuals leave prison employed with skills, training, and education, we are all safer. This bill invests a total of $3 million in fiscal year 2023 and $4.5 million each year thereafter to do three things. First, the bill increases DOC's ability to contract with institutions of higher education, including vocational schools and community colleges. Second, it creates a public safety and economic opportunity unit at the Department of Corrections to establish partnership with trades, schools, unions, and public and private employers. The unit will help individuals connect with jobs and assist with navigation of employment. Finally, for those incarcerated individuals who qualify for work release, it allows them to instead of continuing with their ongoing full-time education. Members, in your inboxes and also posted on the committee website, there are several documents and letters of support for this initiative. These letters expressly support the bill and the critical programs and impact on public safety that they represent. As you all are aware of, we are struggling with workforce. With the labor force participation rate going down, we used to lead. We need to go back to above 70%. Every employer is seeking an opportunity to bring back those individuals who've been locked out from employment. With that, Mr. Chair, thank you for your consideration. I also have the DOC Commissioner Schnell testifying on this bill.
Very well. Thank you, Chairman Noor. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Schnell. Give us your name for the record and testimony. We appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Paul Schnell, and I'm the Commissioner of Corrections. I want to first thank Representative Noor for authoring this package. It meets really two challenges. We all know Minnesota today is facing both an increase in crime and very real workforce shortages. Our budget, the governor's budget, will reflect the belief that a comprehensive approach to responding to crime and making sure that we're investing in what works keeps our communities safe. Communities are safe only when the state and all of us work together to offer opportunity and hold people accountable and deliver justice and meet the needs of Minnesotans. And that's what you'll see reflected in this proposal and the governor's budget more broadly tomorrow. Today, I'm pleased to have the chance to talk about this bill. And I'm, first of all, want to say I'm really grateful to Representative Noor for his authorship of this bill and laying this out so well. As he mentioned, you received a variety of input and background letters from various people along the way here. I lost my screen. One second. So we have a variety of letters you have seen along the way, and I want to spend a little time talking through some of the details. It's important that we look at this because 95% of the people who enter our prisons will return home to communities across our state. And our safety depends upon their successful reintegration into society. This package helps increase the chances of that by paving a pathway from prison to employment. People who engage in educational programming and who are gainfully employed have significantly better chances of succeeding when they're back in the community. And this is not a new idea in Minnesota. In fact, Minnesota has historically been a national leader on this front. In 1893, Minnesota's 12th governor, Newt Nelson, who his statue stands just outside the front steps of the Capitol, said in an inaugural address, and I quote, "Constant employment is absolutely necessary for the physical and moral well-being and the permanent reparation of those convicted," end quote. And Minnesota's own U.S. Supreme Court Justice Warren Burger once met with those incarcerated pursuing education and spoke at a graduation ceremony at Stillwater. And Governor Al Quie was a strong proponent of these sorts of efforts. And in 1979, he signed a proclamation recognizing Stillwater Prison Education Program as one of the best in the nation. And when Minnesota first envisioned the role of parole agents, their number one duty was to help people find employment, because we knew then and we know today that this is what matters. Today, men and women in the DOC continue their long commitment to transforming people's lives. They work hard to provide as much robust education programming and preparation for employment as possible. The reality is that resources make this crime-reducing work not always possible. There are five core elements to our criminal justice system: retribution, deterrence, incapacitation, incarceration, rehabilitation, and restoration. And if we endeavor, ultimately, with the goal of having no more victims, rehabilitation and restoration objectives must be elevated. Given that Minnesota's unemployment rate for the formerly incarcerated is about 27% compared to Minnesota's 2.9% unemployment rate for others, it's clear that system-involved people can play an important role in Minnesota's economic viability. The Pathways to from Prison to Employment package invests in what works, invests not only in what the data shows us, it invests in what Minnesota's elected leaders from both sides of the aisle have lifted up for over 130 years. Part of the work that will come if you fund this package will bring together both public and private sector employers, the trades and trade unions, technical and community college and post-education opportunities and pathways. Employment navigation will further pave the way that will begin in prison and continue into long-term stable jobs outside of prison. The proposal also helps those who come into the DOC prisons for a short period of time create connections to gain stability as they transition. Several Midwest states are doing similar work, including many of our neighbors in Iowa, Wisconsin, Illinois. Employers also can access the federal work opportunity tax credit for hiring formerly incarcerated people. And as you can see from Indiana's hire program, the staff whose job is really to focus on helping people access livable wage employment. These staffs work on building partnerships between public and private sector to pave these pathways. Indiana's decade-old program now has partnerships with over 8,400 businesses across the state, and they've added thousands of jobs for people who are leaving prisons into the state's workforce in a broad range of fields. And while our current staff do some of this work, they simply do not have the resources to make the dent in Minnesota to address Minnesota's workforce needs with our population. Last year, this committee heard from Jeff Brzezinski, the chief investment officer and strategist at the Fifth Third Bank, about the ways people leaving prison can help address the workforce needs given the unemployment crisis that they face. Mr. Korzenik said, "The deepest and broadest labor opportunity exists among those with past criminal records, given their high rates of unemployment. We cannot forget about this pool of talent." Chair and members, as legislators, I know you see better than I do what the opportunities are here. The communities you serve and represent and the businesses that exist within them are struggling with both crime and a severe workforce shortage. We know that people who've been incarcerated can make excellent workers. A John Hopkins health system study found that this population are often more loyal and reliable workers with far lower turnover rates. And that's the big reason that DOC and our partners are hearing more and more from companies in your communities and from trade unions. From these requests, we hear the desire for partnership for both general and specific skill training to ensure that the people coming out of prison are equipped to fill the jobs that are needed in our state. From a solar power plant on the Iron Range, to glass manufacturers in Faribault, from metal producers in Ham Lake to aluminum smelting firms in Rosemont, the employers are struggling to find workers, and they are eager to partner with the DOC to train up workers to meet their needs. Last year, we met with several trade unions, electricians, carpenters, building and construction trades, boilermakers and bricklayers, and all of them had the same request: provide a level of training and access to incarcerated people to engage them as they come out to become skilled trade workers. So here we are, Chair and members, with an opportunity to advance our economic vitality and help Minnesota's businesses access needed workers and reduce crime. We do this by investing in what works, by developing pathways and opportunities that leads to successful reintegrations as they return to cities, towns, and neighborhoods across our state. Last year, you passed our reentry supports bill to remove some of the barriers faced by incarcerated people, like having an ID card, knowing the location of career workforce centers and services, to name just a few. This bill greatly expands the capacity of this agency to carry out its mission, investing in work to reduce the risk of reoffending is work that ultimately serves the safety of Minnesota. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would stand for any questions you may have or members.
Thank you, Commissioner, for that excellent presentation. Chairman Noor, I don't see other testifiers, and so we'll move to committee. Discussion. We'll begin with Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Schnell, for being here. And it's been a while since I've visited because of COVID. But when I had gone and visited all of your campuses except for Togo, you've got 11 different sites. It seems to me I remember job training in all of them, and maybe I'm not remembering correctly, but you've got MinCor and some, you've got all kinds of different things that you sort of alluded to about carpentry, manufacturing, making docks, furniture restoration, even a virtual heavy equipment operating kind of system that people were learning how to operate heavy equipment. And you were just starting to do partnerships with the trade unions so that they could give you a better training program. And because of COVID, I know that all came to a screeching halt. And even just before COVID, we had the horrible tragedy and murder of Officer Gom in Stillwater, which probably shuttered MinCor for a good while as well. But I'm wondering if you could just help me understand, because I have taken the time to go to all of your sites that have workforce development in it and job training in it. If you could explain kind of where you are now after COVID and what would this do to grow you past this? Because I feel like we just did about a 2.5 year or so, 2 year pause on everything. And I'm really at a loss as to what you're actually doing now. If you could just kind of help me understand where things are at. Thank you, Commissioner Schnell.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, we do continue to provide some work opportunities. Basic skill work opportunities through our MinCor program. We do offer some basic trade, drywalling, some basic furniture building, and those programs are really critical. The reality is we simply do not have the capacity to meet the needs of the number of people that we're serving. And when we're talking to employers and even the trade unions, some of the skills that are necessary for them to come out and meet the demands that are that many of our companies and small businesses need, they're seeking specialized training. And that's really what we're trying to do here, is make sure that we're matching what Minnesota's needs are from a workforce standpoint, and looking at this population not as a drain on the system, but ways that we can do it. So I think we do provide, and we do have some of those opportunities. COVID has been devastating in many cases to a lot of this. But even before, our ability to meet people's needs, especially those people who are shorter term, as oftentimes the challenge becomes they may have a treatment need and they have workforce training needs. And so we really want to make sure that we're addressing those treatment needs as well. And these things can come into conflict. And so having this extra resources to provide this, we believe we'll be able to actually offer more opportunities to meet both a person's skill, a workforce training needs, as well as address some of their treatment needs. And so really what this is about is capacity building. We simply don't have and never really have had the full capacity to meet the needs of the people in the system.
Representative Lillio.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Schnell. So also when I've traveled through your whole system multiple times, the thing that kept coming up over and over again was the lack of space. So how are you going to mitigate the lack of space to actually perform all of these things? That you were running out of space before COVID. So how are you going to mitigate that? And the last thing I want to ask, because I know we've got a lot of bills, is you had been kind of on the beginning of getting some relationships with the trade union so that you've got a seamless transition into their training as well, because obviously you can't do the full training in that amount of time. It's very, if you go to one of their training centers, there's no way you could duplicate that in a prison. It's just too expansive. There's just too much equipment and stuff needed. But have you actually created those partnerships, and that is that ready to go, or are we still kind of where we were before COVID? So those are the two questions, space and the trade unions.
So I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, we do believe we have the ability to meet space, to address the space issues. And some of this is really based upon where we would seat some of this programming, because as you know, some of our facilities have more access to available programming than others. And we're also really focused now on how we use space, trying to maximize that where, you know, you have an education area, you as opposed to just having, you know, you may have one or two classrooms operating, you have an open classroom. We want to use that open classroom to address other types of needs as we go forward. So we've really been doing a lot of work on time and space and how we best utilize that in the facilities to maximize this programming. We also have been looking at our bonding requests as one of the ways to address some of these issues as well. For those of you who are on bonding committees, you would see that some of this has been focused on space. We've been in continued conversations with the unions, obviously, because the prisons were closed down. But there has been some sharing of kind of curriculum activities and trying to focus on what the agreements would look like for bringing people in and providing both just awareness around what the different trades do and what kind of training could be offered inside, and then pathway that as people come out to do the particular trade training that may be available elsewhere in the state.
Very well, thank you, Representative O'Neill. I think those are three excellent questions, and I do want to acknowledge the time and energy that you've put into personally being present in virtually all of our facilities across the state. Thank you for that work. Next, we have Representative Grassley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I do have a question for the author and yourself as well, I would suppose. We're looking at We're talking about workforce issues and demands for the trades and all of that stuff. And that is something that, I've mentioned when I was on the Education Committee, and you were on there as well. And we're talking about getting these trades and these get back into the schools, these trades industries and classes back into the high schools, to get kids, to meet these kids that are not going to go to a four-year school, to keep them from ending up having to deal with Mr. Schnell's area of expertise there. So I'm all in favor of helping the inmates to adjust and prepare for the outside world. But where are we at with making sure that these types of funds are available to our high schools? I guess that would Representative Noor, can you help me with that one?
Thank you, Representative Rouse. You know, I went to a high school that did both trades and the, you know, sort of liberal arts, I suppose, approach. And it was a rich experience, and I do mourn, you know, loss of those trades, you know, present as they used to be in our schools. But Representative Noor, this is right up your alley. I mean, your work is all workforce development, and I think you mentioned education earlier. There's a lot of work to be done, but please, Chairman Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Grassel, for that question. As you're aware of, that funding goes through K-12 for the TCE technical career programs. In fact, we also fund through the Department of Labor to allow more youth to have access. So all those things are happening. But also this bill particularly, it gives people who are in jails to have that opportunity to have a living wage when they come out and to be able to use their skills. And that means we're improving their opportunity in life. At the same time, they can sustain themselves and support their families.
So, Chairman Noor, if we're wise, we're doing both and probably more. Representative Russell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that therein lies my question is, do we want to be getting that money to these schools on the front side so we don't have to deal with people being in prison because they are not utilizing their skills, they're not being trained to become skilled laborers or skilled operators and so on and so forth. So I guess I'm looking at this and I'm just wondering, I mean, you say that it's in the process. Have we done anything to help these schools to get these programs moving again?
And Representative Grassel, I think it's a fair question. It's also, you know, stretches outside the scope of this bill, but I will certainly, I know it's a fair question, but Chairman Noor, and then we'll push on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This speaks to the core of the challenges that we're facing, Mr. Chair and members. If in reality we need to invest, I think we need to put more resources in our school system. They have already offered, we do have funding that goes through the Minnesota Department of Education for career technical education programs, but we underfund every level of education system in our state. So this will be a great conversation to happen in the K-12 arena, and hopefully we can come up with a solution as we discuss how we spend some of the surplus resources that we have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you're talking about that liberal arts education. I mean, all of us need to know how to cook, clean, and sew. And we do also need to have those trades, all of us. So you never know when you're going to have to sew a button back on your shirt.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm old school like you. I agree. Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have got a quick question for the commissioner. You've talked a lot about these programs, and I'm wondering, and they sound great, really. Do these programs, are they going to be able to be done with your existing staff, or are you going to be adding FTEs? And if you are, how many will you be adding?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poston, I think this really focuses heavily on the partnerships, in particular with like our community colleges, and the trade unions, because right now, and even right now, we've done some of this with the current appropriation that we do have. We've been doing some partnerships with some of the community colleges, technical and community colleges, and really have achieved some remarkable things. The numbers are very small, but even some of our, we've had people who've gone through electrician training, for instance, and have, you know, done everything as working even in part with our physical plant people after they've done the more formal training. And that has been remarkable. And I can tell you that there's an employer in Minnesota that will take those people minute one they walk out the door because the need is that great. So you know, we really believe that we by maximizing these partnerships, by having the community and technical colleges that Minnesota has invested in and really has these resources, this is really how we help create these pathways. And then by working with businesses, and you know, DEED is actively involved with this. And so as companies come forward and saying, look, we're looking for employees who, you know, have this particular type of training in manufacturing or printing or whatever it may be. And those are the things where I think we want to be nimble and working with Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, Minnesota State, and to offer those programs to be able to meet those demands and those needs. And really, I would say that one of the places that this has been most pronounced, and it's everywhere, but in greater Minnesota, it's been one of the places where the need has been really, really great. And we've had some really unique conversations with different employers about being able to access these folks and them even talking about things like local housing options. So there are some, I think, incredible opportunities that would achieve the kinds of outcomes that I think we all want.
Well, Representative Paulson.
Commissioner, I understand what you're saying, but I don't know if you answered the question. Will there be any FTEs added, or is it no?
Commissioner.
No. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. It's really, we're doing this through partnership with the educational institutions. So we're not adding FTEs. There is going to be some coordination. There may be a few FTEs for some coordination with DEED and employer access. So that's one of the key things is how do we make sure that the folks who are providing some of the educational opportunities are providing the kinds of opportunities that we need. And so there will be some, there may be a position or two that would help create this economic opportunity in a unit, but much of it is really grounded in the partnerships with higher ed and the technical colleges.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Paulson. Lee Johnson.
Chair Mary Mariani, Commissioner Snell, I want to thank you for spending your time with us today. That's the way it looks. You have a few more bills you can be spending time with us on. One question I have, I mean, first of all, for the author, Representative Knorr, before COVID hit, I was working with a group of business owners and business professionals working on an idea just like this. But their idea was no cost to the state. They were running it themselves, working on getting these the inmates job experience, working with them, lining up jobs and giving them the training. So when they did get out, they were fully employed. And again, at no cost to the state. I was just wondering if those individuals have contacted you or gave you this idea or where this idea came from.
It might be a better question for the commissioner, Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee Johnson, we have been working with and talking with a variety of partners, and we'll continue to do that. That's really what this is grounded in. We've been talking about how do we maximize education to meet the workforce needs. And, you know, you heard this last year from the chief strategist from the Third Fifth Bank who talked about this very issue. And he's been speaking all over the country because of the really profound needs, workforce needs and what the impact on regional and state level of vitality is, if we don't maximize and get as many people working this forward. And so we will, those partnerships, you know, with the Redemption Project is one of them. We have a really good partnership with them. The trade unions are other examples of that. But the challenge of no cost does become a bit of a misnomer, because their ability to provide all of that training, they may provide some of the softer skill stuff around interviewing and those sorts of things, which we absolutely need. But that hard and specific skill training, that's where I think we have to invest, and that's what this is about.
Lee Johnson.
Chair Mariana, Commissioner Sell, thank you for that information. I just things going through my mind. It wasn't that long ago. I think it was there again just before all this stuff hit that we can't meet in person. The biggest complaint you had about programming and doing rehab was the fact that most of the inmates were not there that long. There wasn't enough time to do the programs. Now, a college degree and all this college education, that takes multiple years. If you didn't have time to do the rehab programs, how are you going to have time to do the college programs?
Commissioner Snell, and then I'd like us to move to the last questioner.
Mr. Chair, Lee Johnson, I would say that we talked about the fact that capacity to be able to do this, and that has been our, even during COVID, we've been talking about how do we meet the needs of people for treatment and so forth. And I think we have a good plan that isn't fraught with a big request for additional resources at this point in time, by really looking at targeting to people's needs. And so that's number one. The average person spends 33 months, the average commitment to the Department of Corrections, average, 33 months in DOC custody. We do have the ability to meet their needs by really targeting, again, our interventions, addressing the substance use disorder needs, if there are those, some of the mental health, but the education and workforce readiness has to be, and we have to face the reality that many of the people that we're talking about, you know, didn't come from backgrounds where there perhaps in some cases was that long history of seeing what work can happen and the connections with employers and that sense of that loyalty that many of us grew up with. And really what we're trying to do is create those types of connections and with community-based partners and businesses to make this stuff happen and make sure that the folks who are coming out to those employers are in a position to be successful and make a living wage. Otherwise, you know, when we're releasing 25% of the folks that are going out without a place to live today, you know, I think it raises both a housing question, but it also raises a living wage question. And you know, there isn't going to be a lot of options if you don't have a place to live and you can't get a reasonable living wage job. We can see what the outcome of that's going to be. And these are the things that we're trying to achieve with these objectives. And based on this, we do believe we can meet these needs.
Thank you, Commissioner. It was a good inquiry. I think it does allow us to focus a little bit more on the unique challenges and opportunities that the department faces every day with this particular population of Minnesotans. Representative Zhang, and then we'll move to a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to briefly thank Chair North for bringing this bill forward. And also want to note that before coming to the legislature, I was working in Hennepin County in the Workforce Department, where I work with the Hennepin County DOCCR program, with the Productive Day program and the Sentencing Through Service program, where I've seen firsthand how impactful such programs like what Chair Noor is carrying today would have on society. So I appreciate you doing this, Chair Noor, and I would love to have the opportunity to work with you on this moving forward. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Shaw. Looks like and offered Chair Nord someone else to work with you on this legislation and other work. Chairman Nord, if you can close us out, then we're going to move to a vote.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. The program that we're talking about today for employment, particularly for those who are leaving jails, is an effective, practical, and proven solution to some of the challenges we are facing as a society. And the other issues of out of school time and the young people in school, we're going to be addressing it this session, and I'm hoping to gain your support on that, and I ask for your support on this initiative. Thank you, Mr. Chen, members, and thanks to Commissioner Schnell, and also for the offer from Vice Chair Jay Zhong, who is the Vice Chair for Workforce and Business Development. Thanks.
Fantastic. Thank you, Chairman Nord. With that, Representative Frazier renews his motion that House File 4215 be referred to the Committee on Workforce Development. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Lee Johnson.
No.
Lee Johnson, nay. Rep. Edelson.
Aye.
Edelson, aye. Rep. Feist.
Aye.
Rep. Feist, aye. Rep. Grossel.
No.
Rep. Grossel, nay. Rep. Hollins. Rep. Hollins.
Aye. Oh, sorry,
Rep. Hollins.
Aye.
Rep. Hollins, aye. Rep. Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Rep. Cleavorn.
Cleavorn, aye.
Rep. Cleavorn, aye. Rep. Long.
Aye.
Rep. Long, aye. Rep. Lucero.
Lucero, no.
Rep. Lucero, nay. Rep. Mueller.
Rep. Mueller votes yes.
Rep. Mueller, aye. Rep. Novotny.
Novotny, no.
Rep. Novotny, nay. Rep. O'Neill. Rep. O'Neill. Rep. Pinto.
Aye.
Rep. Pinto, aye. Rep. Poston.
No.
Rep. Poston, nay. Rep. Raleigh.
Raleigh, aye.
Rep. Raleigh, aye. Rep. Vang.
Aye.
Vang, aye. Rep. Shung.
Aye.
Rep. Shung, aye. Last call for Representative O'Neill. Representative O'Neill absent. Chair with 13 ayes, 5 nays, and 1 absent. That concludes roll call.
Very well. With 13 ayes, 5 nays, 1 absent, the motion does prevail. And House File 4215 is referred to the commission to the Committee on Workforce Development. Thank you, Chairman Nord. Thank you, Commissioner. Next, we have Representative Keeler, House File 4224, and Vice Chair Frazier, I'm going to ask you again if you'd be willing to make a motion. This one would be to refer to the Committee on Ways. Oh, we're going to lay this over. Looks like this is a layover. So the chair will move House File 4224 to Ways and Means with the intention of laying this over. So we won't be taking a vote on that, but I'll be moving to lay this over for possible inclusion. Representative Keeler, your bill is before us. Welcome to the committee. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and members. Today I'm here to talk to you about House File 4224, which is a really basic bill asking for appropriation to fund the Healing House Project Manager. One of the things that I've learned as I've been listening in many spaces with our Department of Corrections, specifically tied to our Indigenous women, is that we know that the population across the state, we only make up 1% of this population. Yet in the DOC prison systems, Native American women make up 20% of that population. That's staggering. And we also know that when we have women that come out of incarceration, cultural supports are extremely important in getting them back on track. So I'm really happy to present this bill, and I'm gonna yield the rest of my time to the testifiers so they can tell the story of what's happening in this space.
Very well, thank you, Representative Keeler. We do have a number of testifiers. We will begin. It looks like we're starting with you, Commissioner Schell.
Again, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I want to first just thank Representative Keeler for your support of this proposal for Healing House and for ensuring that what we do in this around this work is not done in a siloed way. The governor, lieutenant governor, my fellow commissioners, and I am grateful for the work of our partners, Violence Free Minnesota, the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition, and the Northwest Indian Community Development Center, who have led in partnership with the DOC's Victim Services team. And it is from that this proposal is taken out a life. In addition, I remain in awe of the strength of many Native American women who shared their stories with us. And it is from these stories that we become accountable to act. While corrections systems are not historically known for advocacy, we nonetheless can see within the system we operate and services we provide the impact of unaddressed trauma, and we cannot stand by idly. Although we are here in wholesale support of this bill, the DOC is not the owner of the Healing House concept. Healing House, an inclusive, trauma responsive, and culturally specific continuum of housing and other resources, comes from lived experiences of Native American women, and this belongs to the community. And I'm here and honored to support it. And with that, I'd like to hand over the time to our partners to share more.
Very well. Thank you, Commissioner. We have Nikki Engel from Violence Free Minnesota. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and give us your testimony.
Yes, Chair Mariani and members of the committee, I'm Nikki Engel, and I work for Violence Free Minnesota, the statewide coalition with over 90 member programs who provide advocacy and services to domestic and sexual violence victims in all of Minnesota's 87 counties. I'm testifying today in support of House File 4224. Over the past 4 years, Violence Free Minnesota, the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition, Mending the Sacred Hoop, and the Northwest Indian Community Development Center have partnered with the Minnesota Department of Corrections on a grant project to improve criminal justice system responses to victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. House File 4224 is a direct result of the findings from this grant project and our coalition's joint recommendations to the Department of Corrections. This grant allowed us to interview 62 Native American women who were currently or formerly incarcerated at MCF Shakopee. Our interviews with these generous women touched on their histories of victimization, criminal justice system involvement, experiences in prison, motherhood, and reentry needs. We found that all but one of the women we spoke with had a history of relationship abuse and or sexual violence prior to incarceration. The vast majority of our participants had experienced multiple forms of violence prior to incarceration, and they drew direct and indirect connections between the violence and abuse they had experienced over the course of their lives and their involvement in the criminal justice system. Native American women, both in Minnesota and nationally, are overrepresented in our incarcerated populations and disproportionately experience violence, abuse, and homicide. The Healing House is an opportunity to support the development of an innovative housing model for correction system involved women, allowing them to heal from the trauma of domestic and sexual violence in a safe and supportive environment. We urge you to support House File 4224. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Engel. Next, we have Ms. Linda Thompson of MIWSAC. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and give us your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. Wasa ya kwe indigo. My name is Linda Thompson. I am a member of the Boys Fort Band of Ojibwe with lineal ties to both Leech Lake and Mille Lacs Lake. I am the operations director for the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition. We're a statewide tribal coalition serving 40 member programs and 117 individual members. I am here today in support of House File 4224 to provide management services in support of the Healing House model. Here is some more information about the data and the information that we gathered during our interviews. Of the women that we interviewed, 75% of the interview participants were affiliated with Red Lake Nation, the White Earth Nation, and the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. These three nations surround Beltrami County up in northern Minnesota. 29 of the women that were incarcerated in Shakopee at the time of our interview, 33 women were incarcerated in Shakopee within the past 5 years of being interviewed. Housing was the number one barrier to successful reentry as identified by the participants. 83% struggled with secure, safe, affordable housing. 90% of the women were mothers. it was critical to most of the women that they return to or near the communities where their children and families were located. Reestablishing their relationships with their children was one of their highest priorities. 184 children were impacted by the incarceration of these women. Today, we are asking for your support with the development of this unique, culturally based housing model for Native American women who are re-entering their communities from the Department of Corrections. And we urge your support for House File 4224. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson. Next, we have Liz Richards from the Department of Corrections.
Oops. Chair Mariani, yes. I appreciate the invitation. I'm here to answer questions. I believe the last testifier is Natasha Kingbird with the Northwest Indian Community Development Center.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Richards. Good to see you. I actually don't have that name as a testifier. Is that, and I apologize, I missed the name that you mentioned. Ms. Richards?
Chair Mariani, Natasha Kingbird.
Okay.
She is here.
Oh, very well. Please come forward and state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. Bonjour, my name is Natasha Kingbird. I am a member of the Nation and reside in Bemidji. I am the lead for the Ombushkab program at the Northwest Indian Community Development Center. I am testifying today in support of the House File 4224 to provide funding for project management services in support of the Healing House model. The Ombushkab Reentry Program provides comprehensive, culturally specific services for our Anishinaabe and American Indian relatives, both men and women who are returning to the community following incarceration. I have been in this role for the past 6 years and have seen and heard firsthand needs of our community. Members of our program, our families, and our relatives highlight how a lack of continuum of transitional and permanent supportive housing in Bemidji and Greater Minnesota contributes to a cycle of incarceration, homelessness, substance use, and separations of our families. Upon release, our members struggle with building and sustaining supportive social networks and safe environments. Furthermore, current models of transitional and supportive housing fail to recognize the importance and strength of our Anishinaabe culture as healing, as prevention. The Healing House model project will provide an entry point for members to stabilize and prepare for reentry back into the community. This is an innovative, community-led and designed project that will ultimately add units of transitional housing, promote cultural reclamation, and model restorative justice. We urge your vote to in support of HF 4224, and with that, miigwech.
Very well, thank you, Ms. Kingbird. I do show Ms. Katie Kramer from Violence Free. I'm not sure if she's intending to testify, but just opening up that space right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm also just here for questions.
Very well. Well, let's do that then. Thank you all for your excellent testimony and for the work that led to the creation of this bill. Members, discussion? Representative Keeler, it is our intent to lay this over so it won't be the last time that we will be having a discussion and a consideration of this bill. I do hear a name or a voice, rather.
I don't know if you can see it, but Representative Edelson has her hand up.
I do see that now, Representative Edelson.
That's okay, Mr. Chair. I think it's blending in with the wall.
Could well be.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keeler, I want to thank you for bringing this bill. So I have a background, and I don't talk about it often in this community, in clinical social work. And this bill is so great on so many levels because it's really looking at a holistic view of a person, but it's also culturally specific, which I love. And so I just wanted to thank you and to everyone that worked on this. We need to see more housing like this. I've also worked and did some work within Shakopee, and just to those of you that were thinking about housing as a need after somebody leaves, so important for people to be able to be successful in that reentry regulatory process, but also to have their kids a part of their life. So thank you all for your work. I'm very supportive of this bill. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. Lee Johnson. Lee Johnson, are you on mute, perhaps?
Unfortunately, I was, Chair Mariani.
All right.
Chair Mariani, Representative Keeler, I do like the concept of this bill. We need to do everything we can to make sure that those that are incarcerated can come out and can have a possibility of staying out, the best possibility they can of staying out of prison forever. I do not want them to go back. Our goal is to get them back into the community, back being productive citizens of this state. The only question I have for you is this facility just for those that are have been incarcerated, or those that are challenged somewhat because of the situation they found in? If they're on probation, are they also going to be eligible to get into this housing and this program to help them?
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Johnson. That's a really good question. I'm going to pass it over to my testifiers. I don't know which one. Nikki, are you? Or Liz?
This is Liz Richards.
Liz Richards.
Yeah, Chair Mariani. Representative Johnson. No, this is not just restricted to people coming from the DOC. This is not going to be a DOC house ultimately, but it will be for, so any justice involved woman would be eligible. So being involved on a county-based level, probation, so that's the concept that it will hopefully forestall certain women from actually ending up at Shakopee, as well as being a space for those coming out of prison.
Very well. Can you state your name for the record, Ms. Richards?
Oh, I'm sorry, Chair Mariani. Liz Richards with the Department of Corrections.
Very well. Okay. Members, like I said, we're going to lay this over, so we're going to continue this conversation. For those who came to testify, that is not a bad thing. It means that we're going to continue this conversation. There's a strong interest in this committee to move forward with your proposal. Representative Keeler, why don't you close us out before the chair lays the bill over?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members, for listening to this. I think it's really important that when we reach out and we ask our communities what they need to be successful in this life, we listen. We listen, we hear, we invest, and that's what this is. We've done a lot of time listening to the women in our communities and hearing what the needs are and hearing where the gaps are at. And so I just really encourage you all to listen from that lens and make your decisions from that space. Ulamae, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Representative Keeler, for a good bill. And I do agree. And I also again want to thank testifiers, particularly those who spent the time with our Native American sisters in our state, surveying them and hearing and listening to their realities and then responding accordingly with this legislation. Thank you. That's very fine work. With that, the chair moves. The chair will lay over House File 4224. Thank you, Representative Keeler. Representative Pinto, House File 4191. Representative Pinto moves to refer House File 491 to the Early Childhood Committee, where I think there's a representative by the name of Pinto who chairs that committee. So, Representative Pinto, your bill's before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to dive right on in, members. So House File 4191 creates a family support unit at the DOC and then appropriates $1.5 million a year to support connections and programming between incarcerated individuals and their families. And this is especially aimed at incarcerated moms and dads, which means it's aimed at the kids of those parents. And so, members, you hear me a lot on other bills regarding other aspects of public safety. This really pulls in this huge passion of mine of getting young kids off to a great start. I want to highlight for us the double payoff of this kind of spending for the incarcerated individual on the one side. Research is super clear. If you are in custody, and just think of any of us, if you are in custody and you lose contact with your family, that is going to put you in a really bad place, a worse place. Having that contact reduces recidivism, is better on the one side. But on the other side, having an incarcerated parent is an adverse childhood experience, or ACE. And again, lots of research showing that when you have an ACE, an adverse childhood experience, you have all kinds of bad, much higher likelihood of bad outcomes in your life, including all sorts of health conditions later in life. I'd like you to just pause and think to yourself, make a guess as to the number of children in Minnesota who have an incarcerated parent or have had one. Maybe make a guess. And the answer, according to Minnesota Student Survey, is 1 out of every 6 children have that. And so we know that maintaining a connection with a parent has a huge benefit for kids. So the Ombudsperson for Corrections released a report on the need to better support these family connections. The bill responds to that report. And I just want to highlight for you, there are many powerful letters of support in our packet. There's one story that I think I won't get into right now, but I'm going to urge you to read the letters. Really, really powerful support for this. And it's got all kinds of benefits. And Mr. Chair, I believe that Commissioner Schnell is with us. He may be the testifier. Maybe wrong about that, but.
Yeah, Chair Pinto, I've just been urgently notified by staff that we're going to have to adjourn. I had hoped to get some extra time. We could probably squeeze in a minute of the commissioner's testimony, but I think our wise move then would be to lay this over and then bring this bill back for a little bit more conversation. I apologize.
No problem.
Commissioner, if you can give us a 60-second version of your thoughts, and we'll come back, so the floor will be open to you again when we do that.
Mr. Chair, thank you so much. I just, I think this is kind of lays out, we really want to create this family support unit. This builds on last year's Health Start Act, which really received a ton of attention both in Minnesota and across the nation. And that program is now up and going, which is really exciting. I would just point out that in addition to the recidivism stuff, and tie this back a little bit to the education component, we know that when parents who are incarcerated are in contact with their children who are in education, and especially when those incarcerated parents are involved in educational efforts inside the prisons, that the outcomes are better for both. And I just think it really speaks to kind of tying the connection between a lot of this. And I look forward to the opportunity to talk more about this. And I'm grateful to Representative Pinto for offering this.
Thank you, Commissioner. And thank you for the work in the Healthy Start Act, which wound up being a pretty strong bipartisan effort on the part of our body. So Representative Rowley, I do apologize to you. We will certainly come back to you when we do bring this bill back up. I am looking at having conversations with Chair Pinto about doing a joint informational hearing on a number of issues that overlap our two committees. This is a prime example of where that might be. I do apologize for all members. I'm being told by our IT folks they might plead for extra minutes. This is not possible this time, but we will come back to this bill, absolutely. Representative Pinto, with that, the chair is going to lay over House File 4191. And members, being pressed with time, we're going to move to adjournment. We will be back tomorrow. Your presentation, budget presentations from both Department of Corrections and the Department of Public Safety. Lee Johnson.
Chair Mariani, with first deadline coming next Friday, I'm just wondering if you've given a little bit of advance notice of what the plans are for next week. We already know that Judiciary is meeting Tuesday night, and a number of the members on this side of the aisle are on both committees. Just give us an idea what to expect for next week.
Representative Johnson, I certainly will do that. I'll be meeting with my staff tonight to shape up some decisions, and as soon as I have that, I will reach out directly to you to share with that and with your caucus members.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Members, with that, until tomorrow, this committee stands adjourned.